Committee on Criminal Law to order. They first, they will have days of public hearing on House Bill 3337. Representative Anderson.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the subcommittee. Thank you for a chance to hear this bill. I have brought with me a constituent from Southern Oregon who also would like to speak. Mr. Robert Alboni, I believe he's signed up. We also have a gentleman, I believe, from the state police who is a polygrapher, and he also will be is signed up to testify. Children's Services has a difficult job of protecting children from abusive situations, physical, sexual, and others. And their stated goal is essentially to protect children. Difficult job, overwhelming job, I'm sure, at times. And I think generally they do an awfully good job. Their stated goal as well is to restore families and to bring the families back together again, as if is there any chance for that to happen. I think, unfortunately, as in all of life, sometimes that plan goes wrong. And whether it's personalities that get in the way or facts that get turned around, oftentimes there are situations where the credibility of either the children or the parents can get turned upside down. The bill that we're bringing to you today, 3337, basically asks for ways in which, and it's generally the parents whose credibility is challenged, not the children, because the department has the goal to protect the children only. They're not concerned especially with the parents as much. Maybe that's stating it a little too strongly, but their main primary goal is to protect the child. There are times, and I'm sure you've seen it in your constituency, I have seen it a number of times, and now I seem to be the target of people writing in to say that they're having a problem with credibility before DHS. It came to several of us in discussion that possibly using a polygraph in civil cases, it cannot be used in criminal cases, but can be used often in civil cases, could be a help in establishing credibility for a family that feels that their story is not being heard or not being heard right. And so basically what we're asking in 3337 is that the polygraph paid for by the parent, or if in their indigency, the polygraphers who are out around the state, I believe there's four or five of them that are qualified for the state police and sheriffs and city police offices, plus the private folks that can do polygraph and do it accurately, that they could be used for indigent defense as well. But generally, it would be the parent or the person whose credibility is being challenged would pay for this. The results would be then forwarded to either the Citizens Review Board or a multidisciplinary task force, which most all of the counties have, or it could be passed directly to the judge. The idea being, and the hope is, that we could head off a number of cases going to a major full court hearing and court custody case by establishing that maybe the child is not telling the truth, maybe the parents are telling the truth, and that they should have a hearing before the judge in the up front before we get to the huge costs of court hearings. I had one case in our area where we tabulated the costs at about $53,000 in a child custody case on the state side, and probably $30,000 on the family side before they ran out of money and had to protect them and represent themselves in court. So these can get very costly, not only for the family, but especially for the state as well. And we need, I think, to be able to spend our money more on the family rather than on expensive court hearings. I have a parent here with me this morning who would like to tell you a little bit about the situation in which he found himself caught, and he was bringing another lady up as well who got tied up in California and couldn't get back in time to get to Grants Pass to catch the ride north. So he may share some of the facts on her case as well. They're very close friends, and I've worked with both of them. Then I also have two letters that I'd like to read into the testimony, and we would like to hear a little bit of the accuracy of the polygraph and how it could be used from the gentleman who is qualified as well. But I'd like to, at this point, turn it over to Robert Alberoni and have him tell his story.
Good morning.
If you'd please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Robert Alberoni.
Thank you.
My children, I have five children, youngest 19, oldest 23 years old, and I spent 12 years in the system with Children Protective Services. My ex-wife, who is paranoid schizophrenic and who has a brother who is now a three-time convicted felon, thought it would be a good idea when her brother got out of prison to have my children spend time with him, because she had custody of the children at the time. Initially, when Child Protective Services contacted me, it was because her brother had been picked up in a high-profile case in Southern California for picking up a four-year-old child and taking him to a park and molesting him in one of the public bathrooms. So Children Protective Services came to me and told me that they would rather give me the children than have the children go into foster care. Because of what they had been through, the children had to go through multiple classes, which involved 5 days a week of counseling and therapy to help get the children back on track. Went through this for about a year and a half, 5 days a week, taken into all kinds of therapies. And then as the custody proceedings were about to complete themselves, they found out that we were in Southern California at the time. They found out that we were in Orange County. We were actually physically in Los Angeles County, a block out of the Orange County jurisdiction. So the case jumped over to L.A. County. We got a new caseworker. The caseworker decided to start from square one, and none of the paperwork was transferred from Orange County. So I became the bad guy, and I had to go through all the classes again. Regardless, she wouldn't listen to the fact that everything had happened through my ex-wife and through his brother, but now I had to jump through all the hoops. Part of the problem with the department is that they don't listen. They don't listen to the parents. Parents are considered guilty, and they have no way to prove innocence. They take the children, they put them into foster care, they separate the families, they destroy the connections, and there's no burden of proof on the state to prove their accusations. Not years later, but 18 months later, after I had custody, my ex-wife went through one parenting class and they gave the children back to her. Within a period of 5 weeks, they had gone from A's and B's to failing all the classes and dropping out of school, living in a crack house with my ex-wife. We would love to have the opportunity to supply testimony, to prove our innocence or to prove a point by taking a polygraph. But the way the system works, we have no way of proving anything. I mean, how do you prove you're innocent when somebody accuses you of something and you haven't done something? How do you prove innocence? You have to have some kind of vehicle in order, some kind of test to take, something that is somebody will believe in order to get some kind of have somebody believe what you're saying to get your kids back. And the way that they do now, parents get excited, they get upset. You get very emotional when somebody comes in and rips your children out of your home. You know, I don't know what else to do. I think the polygraph's a great idea. I would love to have it. I would love for somebody to ask me questions like, is this statement true? Is this statement false? And if it comes out that the polygraph shows it's true, if it were admissible, it would sure help keep the families together. I'm currently CASA. I work out of Jackson County. One of the reasons I became involved is because I have from some people that came to me and from my experiences. I don't go to the CASA meetings anymore. The philosophy of the department is to keep the families together. The philosophy of CASA is to keep the families together. But when you go to the meetings, it's all about how we've rescued children. And a lot of times they haven't rescued children. Families are torn apart. To me, that's a sad thing, that families are being torn apart. But some children are rescued. They do good jobs in some areas. But many of the families that are torn apart, it's just because of a philosophical difference. It's because the house is dirty and the house is clean. There were animal feces on the floor and it didn't get cleaned up. Children get pulled out of homes for that and sent to foster care. And in most cases, the foster care is not as good as the homes that they were taken out of. When the ASPA law was introduced 4 or 5 years ago, it promotes federal funds are sent to the State Department, and it promotes taking children out of homes and adopting them out. They get $4,000 to $6,000 per child for that. There's no matching funds to help reunite the family. They're going to spend $4,000 to $6,000 per child to adopt them out. Why not spend $50 a month to clean up the animal feces off the floor? Why not go in and educate the parents? You know, tell them this is what we want you to do. If you just follow these rules, then there's not going to be any problem. But what they do is they come in and they sweep the children out, and then they ask you to follow these rules, and then in a lot of cases, children don't come back to the home.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Any questions, committee?
No. Just one. Could you run by us one more time, please? The source of the $46,000 and who receives that? And is
$4,000 to $6,000 per child, depending on whether the child is mentally challenged or not in any way. The state agency, the Department of Children's Services, receives federal funding from the federal government, and the source of that is the paperwork filed last year by the Department of Children's Services controller. It's their own paperwork.
Okay, thank you.
I have a copy of that, and I will get that to you.
Thank you.
As far as the polygraph, I recently received a letter. There's 44 private and 13 police polygraphers in the state. And why wouldn't you? You could. There's nothing that would prohibit you now from seeking a polygraph. I mean, the question is why would
that? That is true. The direction of the polygraph results to the CRB. And or the multidisciplinary team, or directly to the judge, is the intent of this, to make sure that the information gets to the place where it should, to head off the normal procedure that seems to be in place.
If I was your attorney, and you told me I'm innocent, I believe, and you take a test and it's inconclusive or shows deception, if I'm your attorney, I'm probably not going to recommend that we send that on up to a judge. And that, so, in fact, I would think an attorney would really be hanging out.
True. I talked to an attorney yesterday, and she said that probably is true, that she would. But if a parent feels strongly enough or doesn't have representation, which one of my clients did not, one of my constituents did not, and they felt challenged enough, this would allow them to go directly to and have a polygraph exam done.
Okay. But they could do it now, but this is...
It's pretty vague. It's pretty vague, and it isn't a recommended procedure.
Right.
Mainly goes through the attorney if there's an attorney involved. Mm-hmm. This really authorizes the family to go directly.
Okay.
I'd like to read a letter into the record. This is directed to Chair Delto in the Human Services, but it really applies here. Hello, my name is Amanda Boatman, and my three children were taken away by DHS because my daughter has a behavioral problem, i.e. she will lie to get her way, and has severe anger problems as well. This is an 11-year-old. I cooperated with DHS and graduated from their classes, and all along I repeatedly told them that my daughter had lied about us. But DHS refused to give credence to my words. DHS insisted that children never lie. This is a serious problem. As my family has been torn apart over a lie, and DHS promised all along that their goal is to return my kids, and now they tell me that they are seeking to adopt them to a foster family. This is a situation where I think we need to be able to move in to the middle and say, maybe the parents do have credibility. Maybe a child, I don't know of any child, I certainly not me, that didn't tell a lie at a time or two. And I think we need to be able to prove the credence of an adult who claims that they are telling the truth. If they're willing to take a polygraph, if they're willing to pay for it, that in itself would tell me something. And I would hope that we'd be able to get some credibility for the parent.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions?
Well, I guess I want to, Mr. Chair, follow up a little bit where you were going, driving with this whole thing, too. I understand what the Chair mentioned, Representative Anderson, about, I mean, a parent has that right now to pursue someone polygraph, to have that examined. Your intent on this is to actually just plug it into the statute itself for DHS to recognize that then?
And for the parent to be able to take those results to the Citizens Review Board or the Multidisciplinary Task Force, or even to the judge, if they could direct it directly to the judge.
Okay.
But what if the results are bad? And they, I mean, so how, but
that's their risk. That's their risk.
So any polygraph that's taken, the information would go forward regardless.
Seems to me that if I were telling the truth and wanted to take a polygraph test, I'd take that chance that the 5% or so that it might turn out bad, as opposed to a 95% chance, as I understand it, that it will secure credibility. And it seemed to me if my, and I, we're talking with Mr. Alberoni coming up, that that's a chance he'd be willing to take to get his children back.
And the polygraph, as you know, is not accepted in criminal court because of
that's
the
right.
They consider it not reliable
that.
Enough. But, okay.
But this would be for civil cases.
Okay, thank you.
I have a very close friend. Her name is Tina Riorowitz. Tina has lost her four children. They were adopted out 18 months ago. Her case was accelerated at one point in time. Initially, the kids were picked up. There was an outstanding investigation, an investigation that started 2.5 years prior regarding domestic abuse. They followed up and started having discussions with Tina and decided to come in and take the children. They came in and took the four children out of the home. Then her husband was accused of stalking the caseworker because the caseworker supposedly saw the car somewhere around her vicinity, somewhere around her home, which she thought was his car. Tina would have loved, or her husband would have loved to have been able to have the opportunity to take a polygraph to prove that they weren't stalking the caseworker. And he had proof, he had testimony from people at work saying that he was at work at the time. But once it's written into the paperwork of a caseworker in the Department of Children Services, when they write something down, as far as the system is concerned, it is the word, that's the way it is, that's the way it happened. And parents have no way to prove themselves innocent of a charge. It's not like they're charged with some kind of criminal act. They don't be charged with anything. The system makes an allegation. There's no burden of proof. They come in and they take the children out of home and they do whatever they want to do without ever proving a case. And that's the way the system works currently. So in cases like this where they're accused of stalking somebody and they have no way of proving their innocence, it's their word against the other person's word. If they were able to take a polygraph test, mm-hmm. then they could prove their innocence.
Mr. Chair, how would this bill address an accusation of stalking? I mean, this bill is written only to address an abuse. There's nothing in this bill, in my opinion, that would require a polygraph examination if there were an allegation of stalking by a...
It's not about requiring. It's about the ability to have to preclude your innocence.
Right, but this is about proving your innocence if you've been accused of abusing your child, not because you've been accused of stalking the DHS worker.
Abusing your child is a very broad term. They have many definitions of abuse.
Yes, yes, sir, I know, but... None of the definitions of abuse would include stalking a caseworker. They just wouldn't.
Ms. Mullett, I think what we're trying to say is that there are many cases where credibility on the parents' side is trashed. And that's what we're trying to fight, that the parent needs to be able to tell the judge, I am a credible person. And I think that would, if I were on the bench, I'd be looking at that person and saying, maybe there's another side to this case. Maybe we shouldn't head headlong into court, but rather the department should take another tack before they either adopt out or seek permanent custody, that there's some validity on the other side. It's not just all on the credibility of the child, who may be a 8-year-old.
As you know, one of the things we've learned on, and here we'll create a law, and then all of a sudden it won't work because these kind of things it doesn't say. There is nothing in the abuse that talks about the stalking, so that I think is correct, that Ms. Wall is correct on that. But and a person could still today, you could go get an order if they thought you were stalking. I mean, you could go get take a polygraph on your own.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. Mm-hmm. Any further questions?
I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm hearing you say is that essentially an agency is making an accusation and there is no administrative way to redress or rebut that decision by an agency, and you just merely want to have this as a tool, using a polygraph to use as evidence to prove that they're incorrect in their assumptions. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's correct. We would like some way to stop the juggernaut that gets going in a number of cases where a child makes an accusation. I had another case, the Jameson case in Josephine County, where a 15-year-old girl ran away from home several times. The parents sought her out. The police brought her back. After this had gone on several times, she talked to some of her girlfriends, and her girlfriends said, the easiest way to get out and get away from your parents is just accuse your dad of sexual abuse. She did. Bingo. She's out of the home for good. The parents said, no way. Ask all of our friends. Any way we could prove our credibility, they could not prove that they were credible. But the girl was lying. The girl went on to live with another part of the family. She accused a cousin then of sexual abuse. All of the family said she's a pathological liar, but the department listened to her, wouldn't listen to the folks. That's the situation somehow, and I hope a polygraph being much more available and the results of the polygraph being much more available would stop this juggernaut that often goes on. Small percentage of cases, but a real problem when it occurs.
One more follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe, as I look at this bill, maybe it doesn't go far enough in instructing the agency, making the accusations, to consider the polygraph. Apparently, that's the problem now. You can request a polygraph test, but they don't consider it. Mm-hmm. It's not part of their consideration of your innocence. So,
did you get the?
Apparently not.
Engrossed it. It's not the final engrossed copy, but there is a. And if you look in section one, sub three. It says, described in subsection this, to a local citizen review board or to the local multidisciplinary team for review. And we are open to amendments from here where it might be submitted directly to the judge.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think we can agree that this is probably the third or fourth bill that we've had things pointed out to us that there's been problems in the Department of Human Resources. And it's only, this is part of a bigger, you know, there's a whole bunch of things involved, part of a bigger problem. You can recall that Representative Crummell had some people that hadn't talked to him came up from Klamath Falls and sat here and told us what they went through for months because this agency just plain doesn't do its job. And it's been about 2 weeks ago. I met with the director along with Representative Richardson. I think they're making some progress, but it's been slow progress. And there seems to be a reoccurring over a long period of time. The inability of parents to be heard And that truth, when it came, trying to ascertain that truth isn't what they try to do. The children are coming out of the homes, and I told the director that I felt that her agency in some situations, maybe 50% of the time, was a bigger abuser of families and children than the offenders were. And I still believe that. If you go look at the total, you know, I was with the state police for 28 years, and I saw some of it there. I saw an accusation by them that my daughter had murdered my grandson when he died. When I brought Ramona in, I let her know in no uncertain terms that those type of accusations by unqualified people who have not done their homework, are not trained criminal investigators, they've somehow got to clean up the agency. I think this bill can be amended a little bit stronger, as Representative Thatcher thought.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need to think about doing that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Salazar and Kelly Sky, if you want to. Or maybe Kelly, wait here. Yeah, looks like you got a full table.
Yeah.
Just please identify yourself and then go right ahead.
Let me get myself situated here.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sam Salazar. I'm a lieutenant with Oregon State Police. I manage the major crime section, which is a polygraph unit is one unit within that major crime section. With me, I've got two detectives. Myself, I'm not a polygraph examiner, but Detective Hedner and Bryant, who I have here with me, are both licensed polygraph unit members. You know, there are several issues in this bill that create a concern with Oregon State Police. I'm going to provide some quick background on the information, attempt to explain the areas of concern by providing information on an explanation of the proper use of the equipment, the training, and the established polygraph guidelines that includes the understanding of the use of the polygraph itself. So bear with me a little bit. The Oregon State Police has five polygraph examiners, positions assigned around the state, and these are full operation, full polygraph, full-time polygraph examiners. The polygraph examiners are detectives from the criminal investigation division that are assigned full-time duties, licensed polygraph examiners. The polygraph and the polygraph examination are a very important aspect of what we do as investigative work. But the ability of the polygrapher to properly apply the science is just a process that includes not just the proficiency of the use of the instrument itself, but there's a great deal of training and development to make a detective capable of being able to service and through the use or provide a service through the use of this polygraph. But I do want to make it clear, though, that that regardless of the level of technology and the professional standard followed, the polygraph examination does not replace proper and thorough investigations and should only be used after all other reasonable efforts are exhausted. And so we don't want to make it be the first line in the process of the investigation. We want it to be the last. Under House Bill 3337, making a request for a polygraph by a person under investigation for child abuse will not be an issue with Oregon State Police, as it's basically we do that now anyway. It's anybody can make that request and it's considered. But it should also be noted, though, that the polygraph examination technique has certain limitations that need to be considered prior to conducting the requested examination. Not everybody's suitable to be examined. And as an example, you know, because of possible physical or psychological considerations, examiners are authorized to use their discretion whether or not to examine some subjects. The areas that the examiner considers prior to an examination, considering a particular subject, include serious mental disorders. The subject may be experiencing physical discomfort, mental or physical fatigue, unduly emotionally upset, intoxicated, or subjects below the reason of age. Examining a person in the opinion of the polygraph examiner, not suitable candidate would create a, both a professional and ethical conflict. In looking at the process itself, the questions asked during the proper polygraph examination should be pertinent to the matter under investigation as well. The issues considered in questions are determined by the matter under investigation, but the actual formulation of the question must be left up to the discretion of the examiner. In criminal investigations, there always be an evidential link between the matter under investigation and the person examined to ensure that the integrity of the information during an investigation. Investigators will maintain a tight restriction on the release of information related to a case. In criminal investigations, the Oregon State Police examiners are allowed access to this investigative information, and this allows the examiner to follow the proper guidelines for the proper polygraph examination. In order to honor the request of the polygraph under HB 3337, the polygraph examiner would require latitude, you know, to review this request. This would allow time to identify, as an example, a person who is very emotionally upset and is not a good candidate for the polygraph examination. Also, subsection 3, which is a new amendment, would require the release of the report to a local citizen review board or a multidisciplinary team for review, and requiring the report to be released following examination by the Oregon State Police to a citizen review board would create a conflict with ORS 419B.035, which prohibits release of such reports by law enforcement. DHS will release those reports to law enforcement, but we are not, by statute, we're not allowed to release those any further. We also contend that the release of these reports, investigative reports, could also create a conflict because a lot of times there's multiple cases going on related to this one particular polygraph exam, and it could cause a conflict there with release of information that would harm other investigations. Also, a request for examination under this bill conducted by a private examiner, as I testified earlier, the polygrapher should have information that's pertinent to a certain investigation, and this would require the release of confidential information outside law enforcement and create the same disruptive issues related with these investigations. So the need for release of sensitive information needs to be in tempered with what's going on with the case. So it makes a real difficult situation for Oregon State Police to release those kinds of things because it does affect a lot of investigation inevitably, and you know, it's counter to what we should be doing.
May I ask you, I was accused, my daughter accused me of sexual abuse, and that's in right away, and so I can say I want a polygraph. You're telling me that without being able to do some investigation, am I hearing you right, that it would really be a meaningless exercise at that
the tool is the last portion of deals. Everything should be done before. But when everything is said and done, if a person comes to us and requests that polygraph examination, it's a plus for us because it's another contact, another interview that can only bring out more facts. So it's not an issue where we're going to deny it very likely, unless, like I said, the person does not meet because of the qualifications. But if a person is able to take a polygraph, it's a positive that we would take a polygraph because, you know, we do get a certain percentage of confessions even before the person goes on the polygraph, just because our polygraphers are really trained to do interviews well, and a lot of times it's a positive in any way for that situation.
And without the bill today, if I was to call you and say I've been accused of sexual abuse, I want to take a polygraph, can I come in and take one? Would you give me one?
Normally, normally there's an investigation going on, and we would contact the investigating agency if it happens to be us or our own investigator, and to get reports, because normally what you need the information of what situation is to be able to accumulate all the information to ask the proper questions in the interview, because that's just it's just as important as the process that is the actual taking of the test.
Okay, thank you.
I'm hearing two main concerns. One is that this bill wouldn't allow the latitude of the polygrapher to determine whether a candidate is a suitable candidate for a test, and also that some concern over the release of the reports, that it would be mandatory under this bill. Would you be more amenable to it if it was at the request of the accused?
Well, no, there's also another issue in that, I lost my train of thought, but in that aspect of, excuse me a second, I lost my train of thought. In any case, those are two issues that we have as far as the overall. Is if we, the release of the reports, I think, would be counterproductive to an investigation, and as far as the request itself, we need to be able to say yes, this person is not suitable. And I want to make a point out as well that in a lot of these cases where it's highly emotional subject, that a lot of them may not be suitable for a polygraphic, because that is one of the things that they look at. If the person is too emotional to keep requesting, but it's not. It won't be a suitable candidate for this type of a test.
So would you deny a person submitting deny a person requesting to submit to that test, to give them the test if they really, really wanted to have this polygraph test?
You know, I'm going to have referred to Detective Hebner, who is a polygrapher, and he would be, I think, a better person to answer that question.
I'm Detective Steve Hebner with the Oregon State Police. I'm stationed out of the Springfield office. And I think, simply put, a person merely requesting a polygraph doesn't necessarily mean, even though that person has a great intent, and it's something that they really want to do, doesn't necessarily mean that they're physically capable of performing. After all, a polygraph instrument is a series of highly sensitive medical instruments that are put together, and we are actually measuring physiological changes with respect to that person. If the person is not sufficiently well or fit, or happens to be under the influence of drugs or alcohol, and is not up to standard, then we're going to have to make an attempt and a determination with regard to that person's ability to perform adequately on a polygraph examination. If we deem that the person is capable, then the polygraph would go forward. If we deem that the person is not capable, then we would elect not to perform the examination out of fairness to the individual. It isn't fair to give a person a polygraph examination when you know full well that there are things in play with that particular individual that would cause them to perform less than adequately on the examination. You have to give everyone the ability to pass a polygraph, and that's our concern. Did I answer your question?
Yes, it does, but I'm just wondering, if somebody's willing to take that risk anyway, would you go ahead and, with a warning saying this may or may not be accurate, and go ahead and administer the test if they're paying for it and they really want it?
Representative Thatcher, I would answer you this way. Why would I administer a test to someone when I knew that I couldn't trust the validity and reliability of the result? Because I want to point something out. It's very, very important. There is not one examiner that I know of, particularly in law enforcement, every time I walk into that room, particularly in sex cases involving children, I ask myself this question each and every time. And people who know me know that I do. If I was accused of a heinous act against a child, how could I defend myself? We're very aware of what the problems are with that. It is foremost in my mind when I walk in a room with a man or a woman who's been accused of such an outrageous act against an innocent child. I also never lose sight of the fact that there is a tremendous pressure and moral burden on me, because no matter what, the effect of that polygraph examination, the result is going to have an effect on that person for the rest of their life. It is going to go way beyond that room. And we don't want to lose sight of those things. I don't. And so I'm always looking out for the best interests of the person. I never go into a polygraph examination with my mind made up one way or the other about a person. If I did that, I would be unfair, I would be unfit, and I shouldn't be giving polygraph examinations. I have to make sure that the playing field is level and that person has every opportunity on God's earth to pass that examination. If I do any less than that, I've gone against what I've been trained, and I've gone against the ethical standards of my profession. I hope that helps.
Thank you, it does. And I do have one last question. Is it possible, because I don't know, and I appreciate the feedback,
sure.
And I appreciate the integrity
that.
In which you administer your tests, is it possible that a person could go to you, you say, you know, I don't think you're a good candidate, but they could go to another polygrapher, and they would accept them as a candidate? Is it a subjective determination?
Let me kind of tell you about it. We police our own within the polygraph community, whether we're private examiners or whether we're police examiners. We're not in the business as an industry of testing people until we get a different result. Generally, what happens if a person were to take a polygraph examination, we're all subject to peer review. At the request of a private examiner, or at my request, if a person has taken a polygraph examination with a private examiner, I have a right to request the results of that examination. And what I would expect to get, charts, written reports, notes, score sheet. And then I would do what's referred to in our industry as a peer review. If I found for some reason, I'll just give you an example. Perhaps the relevant questions didn't, in my opinion, address the issue at hand sufficiently, then and only then would I agree to a retest. I would have to be able to hang my hat on something that would make that test less than 100% quality. And then I would agree to a retest. You have three possibilities in a polygraph examination. You have a person who tests in the generally accepted range of no deception indicated, normally accepted as a truthful person. You have deception indicated, which is a range which is normally accepted for an individual who is not being truthful, who has something to hide. And in between, you have a range which is known as inconclusive. Inconclusive means just what it says. The person didn't pass or they didn't fail. The results of the polygraph did not supply sufficient data and information to say one way or the other. And generally, some of the reasons that you can wind up with inconclusives, and I'll just give you an example of why you would find a person falling in this range, physical issues. They have problems, physical problems with health could wind you up in a inconclusive range. The body wasn't adequately giving off valid and reliable information with regard to the questions that were asked. Mental defect. Person's not adequately able to discern the meaning of the questions, the competition between the questions. Those are some issues of why that pretest and qualifying that person as a good candidate for polygraph are so critical. Because we don't really want inconclusives. We would like to get a result one way or the other. But in spite of our best efforts, we know that there is a range that we're going to get inconclusives in. and that's been well documented through research, and there's a lot of research that can support that out there. Does that answer your question?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I was talking more to the suitability before you test them, a subjectiveness, you know, relating to that rather than to the process after you've begun the testing. Just wondering if there is a range of subjectiveness in determining whether a person is suitable to even test to begin with.
Well, you have to do that, and that's generally done in the pretest.
Okay.
I ask them a list of questions. I have a list that I go from. I ask them, how much sleep have you had in the last 24 hours? Have you consumed any illicit street drugs or alcohol? Have you ever? And I want to try to get a handle on the extent of their substance abuse, because all those things affect how people will perform in a polygraph. So there's a whole list of questions that I take the person through ahead of time to determine whether or not they're suitable on that day to take a polygraph examination. What medications are they taking? Have they had any major surgeries in the last 6 months to a year? All of those things are key issues. Does that helpful?
Yes, but I'm just wondering, if you came up with, okay, 5 out of these 10 questions or whatever the list is, if 5 of these are answered in a negative fashion, then they're not suitable, and you know, 4 of them, they're okay. I'm just wondering what's
well, it's an experience. It's based
okay.
on training,
so it is subjective.
And it's a judgment call.
That, okay.
Simply put.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Is that all?
To be posed to Detective Hebner or Detective Brain. If I recall, is it 200 tests that you have to conduct in order to reach certification? And I'm just curious, how many tests have both of you conducted so far now in your career?
I'm Detective Brian, Oregon State Police, Portland, Polygraph Unit. I'm at over 1,100 right now. And that's been in 11 years in the polygraph unit.
Okay.
And you have to appreciate that I am allowed to also have a private practice. I do a lot of post-conviction sex offender testing. And so combined, I haven't really added them all up, but I'm probably over 2,000 exams.
Okay. I have a follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Have either of you ever participated in an investigation where there was child abuse alleged and parent was the suspect involved in this, the examination actually supported the view of the parent themselves? I mean, that they were not guilty.
Yes, I can personally say that.
Yes, absolutely. On more than one occasion.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
Please. Chair Barker and Representative Thatcher, before my train derailed, one comment I did want to make as far as you asked about the concerns of the release of the records and the leeway of suitability testing. One thing I wanted also to make is a really important issue is that, you know, as far as the polygraph should not be used, and it's not designed to be used, you know, in the way we use it, to override investigative information. So if there's an issue here, I think we would be more inclined to pursue with further investigation as opposed to trying to use a polygraph as a catch-all to say yes or no on any particular, especially something as important an issue as this, to make a decision on a polygraph, yes or no. So I think it's very important for everybody to realize that we should be looking at better investigative techniques as opposed to using the polygraph to attend everything or to make a final decision.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose House Bill 3337 for many of the reasons that have been stated by both the proponents and the opponents to this bill so far. I will say that I have been an attorney in juvenile court representing both parents and children, so I have experience in this area. I've also represented parents in criminal court who have been accused of abuse or neglect of their children, so and have used polygraphs in both of those arenas. What I would say is that I agree with Representative Anderson and his constituent that the Department of Human Services has a great deal of power and that the accusations that they make are not always correct. It's a very difficult job that they have, sort of parsing out where who's credible and who's not, and there are a number of tools that we use to come to some level of certainty as to the truth of the accusations. First and foremost of those tools that we have is to appoint attorneys for the parents. I think that representation is very important for parents in these circumstances, whether it's a criminal investigation or an investigation through the juvenile court. And attorneys can use polygraphs. I very much support the idea of using polygraphs, but they are, as the state police mentioned, they are part of the broader investigation, and I've never been able to use one without looking at the totality of the circumstances. The way that we use a polygraph is that we will talk to the prosecutor or the detective who is investigating the case, and we'll get enough information to understand what the actual evidence is that we're talking about. And in those weak cases, those are the cases where polygraphs become very useful. Because a prosecutor or a detective who's investigating a case knows which cases, if there's physical evidence, it's not going to be overridden by a polygraph. If there's no physical evidence and there are some reasons to believe that a child has a tendency towards being untruthful or has some other things going on in their life that may suggest that they could have been untruthful, those are the situations where a polygraph would be useful. Then we also look at the person and whether they are physically and mentally fit for a polygraph, as the state police had mentioned. So I think it's a good tool. Our concern in legislating that it be available in this manner is that it will actually end up being used against the parents. And as the state police testified, they see the polygraph as a tool for them in order to obtain admissions and confessions. And how this works is, if a person comes in, they get a little pretest interview talking about all kinds of things to determine whether they're an appropriate candidate for a polygraph. But many police agencies will use this as an opportunity to interview again about the allegations. And if an answer comes up as deceptive or inconclusive, they may inform the person that that answer was deceptive or conclusive, and that person then may feel the pressure to change or alter that statement in a way that will not be helpful. There's a reason that people accused of crimes have a right to counsel, and that is because your ability to incriminate yourself exceeds your ability to clear yourself. And I very firmly believe this. We are not always our own best representative, and that's why you need to have an attorney, and that's why you shouldn't take part in a polygraph without consulting an attorney and having an attorney who can look at the totality of the circumstances and determine what is best. The other side of that is that when an attorney looks at it and decides, okay, let's consult with a polygrapher, we will hire somebody, and those results will be confidential. As Chair Barker has mentioned, I will be able to hire a polygrapher, consult with them, provide them with the investigative materials, and if the results of that are inconclusive or a failure, that polygraph is confidential and it goes in my file and can't be used against that person. If it's positive, then we oftentimes will go through the peer review process and we'll present it to the prosecutor or to the investigating agency, the state police, or in Portland, the Portland police polygraphers will review the results, and if they agree that it's a strong polygraph result, then the prosecutor or the state will take those results into consideration and oftentimes act on those results. There are some prosecutors who don't believe in the results of a polygraph at all, and that's another problem with this bill, is that getting the results to the Citizens Review Board and to the court won't necessarily get the person where they want to be, because it's not until an actual trial on the allegations that a court could actually act on a disbelief of the allegations. And that's sort of a longer process that I won't go into now, but if anybody wants the dependency court process explained, I'd be happy to meet with you and explain that process. But it's not just a matter of presenting something to the court and the court just saying, okay, I don't believe this, I'm going to dismiss it. There is a process that it has to go through. So, you know, in sum, I think that the reasons behind this bill are very good. And I do agree with the proponents that there is a problem in this area. I just don't agree that this is a good way to address it, and I fear that it will end up backfiring and being used against parents who think that it will help them.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you, Kelly. Maybe I'm wrong, but I didn't think this bill was intended for use in criminal cases, but only in merely rebutting an agency's determination of guilt. And would you have a problem with it being used in that respect, not talking about courts and defense attorneys and all that, but just merely trying to rebut an agency's determination of guilt against a person?
Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher. The other thing that I wanted to mention, just as a sort of something that had been talked about earlier, is that this is a polygraph is not admissible in a criminal case, but it is in civil. That is actually not true. It's not admissible in any court, criminal or civil, because it doesn't pass the scientific reliability standards in order to be admitted in court. So it would never be admissible in court. As for its use to influence determinations made by the agency, I don't have a problem with that if it's done in a matter where, one, it can be effective, and two, that it can't be used against the parent. And my fear is that this would, because there is no person representing the parent to ensure that it's not used against them, my fear is that it would be used against them, and it would be used as yet another investigative tool. And it's important to understand that you really can't separate the dependency proceedings or the juvenile court proceedings involving DHS allegations from the criminal allegations, because frequently those go hand in hand, and that's why we talk about a multidisciplinary team. If someone obviously is accused of abusing their child, there's a criminal investigation that goes on simultaneously. So it's really hard to separate that process.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sky, you mentioned that it's not admissible in court. You're just talking about Oregon, right? Because there's other states in the country that allow it.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you for sure. I know that it's not admissible in Oregon at all.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Ms. Chair, Ms. Sky, if I'm tracking you right, what you've told us is that there's exists currently the opportunity for anybody who's been accused to seek out on their own a polygraph examination at their own expense, and then to bring those results forward and present them to an agency. So the only difference then that this bill would make is that it'd be sort of advance notice that it's going to happen. Is there anything about that process, the fact that it has been, the request has been presented in advance of the examination, that adds any credibility to the result? That is it likely that either law enforcement or that the DHS would give greater credence to the result of that favorable test that was brought forward favorable test of results from this process than one that was brought forward by an accused who had one done privately and could then have withheld the results if they'd been unfavorable.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I can't say that it would necessarily be looked at more favorably. You know, I say that while I think that probably the state, if they offer a polygraph, which they frequently do if they're investigating a person for allegations, generally of sex abuse, in my experience, the police agency or the state police or Portland police will often offer this up, and they will do it before someone's even been accused formally, and so before they've even talked to an attorney, they'll offer it up, and many people then take that and either pass it or don't. Are the results of that polygraph looked upon more favorably than if it had never been offered, but then they met with an attorney and an attorney decided to offer it up? I don't think so, because if the attorney hires somebody privately, gets a positive result, as I mentioned, there's often a peer review. Oftentimes I will arrange for that polygrapher to get their results to someone at the state police or Portland police to review it. You know, it's a positive result, whether it came from the state police or whether it came from my private polygrapher. There really is sort of a respect among polygraphers that I've seen, whereas if they reviewed each other's results and they agree, it's going to carry as much force. The thing that I think people don't understand is that when a parent comes in and denies the allegation, the denial in and of itself and the willingness to risk a bad polygraph examination, I don't see that as getting a whole lot more play in court than saying, no, I want to have an attorney and I want to talk this through with an attorney, because judges and attorneys that are making these determinations in court understand that a person is better represented. Not only does our law not allow a person to be punished for exercising their constitutional right either to an attorney or to a trial, but people understand, as everybody in this room, we're educated people, and we know that if we get in trouble, we should talk to an attorney. We shouldn't go and try to dig ourselves out on our own. And even if we really are innocent, we're almost never going to be our own best advocate. And it's almost always, and anybody who doesn't have a law degree and doesn't regularly practice in juvenile court or criminal court is going to be better off represented by somebody who knows their way through the system and who understands what's admissible and what's not and who has the allegations in front of them. Because as I always tell my clients, you may think that by saying, oh, it was a red car that drove by, that you're helping yourself, but you may not understand that come trial time, it really didn't matter what color the car was, it was what time of day it came by, or it was what color of shirt you were wearing. Instead, the person who is trying to advocate for themselves without representation doesn't know how the case is going to present in court, either in dependency court or in criminal court, and so they just don't have... They're better represented, and I think that everybody at the table recognizes that and respects that. If a person wants to have counsel, it's almost never held against them. You know, I think there are certainly times when the investigators would rather not have them get counsel because they know that counsel is going to stop the questioning. But I don't think that it would ever hurt them in terms of getting a polygraph. That was a very long-winded answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Sky, for those of us who don't have experience in juvenile court, at what point during a DHS investigation does the right to counsel apply? Certainly when the child is removed from the home, there's the shelter hearing. But what about those situations where maybe DHS goes in, says, we have to develop a safety plan, you accused parent need to move out, you non-accused parent can stay here with the children. When does the right to counsel attach on a less formal, no dependency type situation?
Chair Barker, Council Mala, that's a good question, and this sort of gets into the longer story of the process in juvenile court. But when DHS approaches a family and says, we have these allegations, we'd like, you know, we'll say it's the father, we'd like you voluntarily to move out of the home, and we'll leave the kids here with the mother. And they can do that, and that's on a volunteer basis. Now, if the family says, no, we're not going to do that, then what they would need to do is file a petition with the juvenile court. They would have to prove to a judge by a preponderance of the evidence, which is only 51%, that there's probable cause to believe that something happened and that it's safer for the child to have the parent out of the home. At that point, the court is forcefully removing the children or removing the parent from the home if they won't voluntarily do it. And at that point, the court would generally appoint counsel when the children are forcefully removed. That said, I think Council Moat is right that if the family voluntarily agrees to do that during the pendency of the investigation, then they probably wouldn't be appointed counsel during that time, you know, and that may be a time when they don't know that they have, that they should go talk to an attorney or that they could get a polygraph examination. They might not know where to get that, and that certainly is not something that that would be addressed. But I mean, this bill would definitely help that situation where attorneys aren't involved.
Okay, thank you. Anything further? Thank you. Representative Anderson, you wanted to come back up, and Mr. Wygant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Gordon Anderson, representative from State District Number 3, and I'll keep my remarks very brief. Two things I'd like to say to what Kelly has just testified. It is true that indigent defense is available to those who don't have assets, but I've found several cases where a person has assets but runs through them, spends all their money with the attorney. In two cases, the attorney then opted out, left them hanging, but they had enough assets. They might have had a small interest in a home or a car or something that gave them enough assets to keep them from having indigent defense. So there is a zone there where people can be unprotected as far as any attorney defense. I'm pleased to have Mr. James Wygant. He didn't, I didn't notice his signature when I came in, so I didn't mention him, but I'd like to have him testify also. He is a polygrapher on the private side.
Thank you.
My name is James Wygant. I'm a private polygraph examiner. I have been for about 30 years. I've done over 6,000 polygraph tests, many of them on the kinds of issues that you're talking about. And I don't want to be too redundant because much of what I could say would be similar to what you've already heard from other people who have testified, including my colleagues from the state police. One thing that occurred to me as I listened to some of the other testimony was that there's a particular problem that private examiners face if we are asked to deal directly with someone who comes to us on their own and requests a polygraph test without representation of an attorney. And that is that they often don't have any access to the kind of information that I need to be able to put together an adequate polygraph test. Over the years, I've been approached a few times by people in those circumstances, and it has been the rare case in which I have been able to gather enough information to actually conduct a test. What I need are agency reports, some source of information other than the person that I'm going to do the test on. And it's difficult or impossible for them to secure that information. The agencies involved simply don't want to release it to them. On a few occasions, I've contacted agencies directly, and it didn't really make any difference who was asking. The information was not available. So that's probably the one point I would add. I'm certainly sympathetic to Representative Anderson's interests in trying to remedy a problem here. And I too, like these two state police examiners, have had cases in which I felt that somebody was wrongly accused, and the test results indicated that. There have not been many of those. They're the exception. Most cases, when people come in on accusations such as what we're talking about this morning, they don't do well on a polygraph test. And my work is primarily for defense attorneys, so the test results are filed away and remain confidential. So that's really as much as I can add that might be in addition to what you've already heard. I don't want to belabor my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Under this bill, if you ran that test, would it still be confidential, or do you have to forward it up?
I have no privilege as a polygraph examiner. So if someone came to me on their own, I can promise them confidentiality, but I have no way to exercise it. So what I always tell them is I won't give anybody the information unless I'm directed to by the court and threatened with a contempt citation. So at that point, then, yes, I would release the information.
Any further questions?
One final comment. I would like to have for the committee and also for us the ORS that says that this cannot be used in a civil proceeding. Legislative counsel indicated to us that it could be for civil but not for criminal. So I would like from criminal defense attorneys that proof. Thank you very much for hearing us, Bill.
Thank you. Ms. Moore, can you work with her?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll have our council contact close the public hearing on House Bill 3337. As representative, not here. Oh, that's okay. I'll go ahead and move the next one. Okay. House Bill 2984 has been withdrawn today. We'll go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2974. Public hearing on House Bill 2974. Mr. McDonald.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney from Multnomah County District Attorney's Office in Portland. This was a bill that my office asked to be brought forward. Essentially what it does is put victims of crimes where the offender has been found unable to aid and assist or has been civilly committed, put them in the same position of other crime victims so that they would be notified when the person is released from a mental facility or a non-hospital facility as defined in Chapter 426. We asked this to address a particular problem we had in Portland where we had some individuals who were receiving death threats from a person. This person was arrested. They were civilly committed. Then they were released without any notification to the people that this person was threatening, and that was sort of troubling and upsetting to them, and they would have liked to have that information. So if they found somebody on their front step or something, that they would have some idea who this person was and take appropriate action.
So what this would do, if I understand right, it would just put somebody who's had a civil commitment, who's unable because of mental disease or defect to proceed with a trial, and they're taken away. Then when they come out, the victim of that event would have the same rights as a victim of somebody who went to prison and is coming out.
Correct. Okay. Or who had been found guilty but insane and under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
I think you have any questions?
I have some questions, yeah. Mr. Chair. Mr. McDonald, I need some just sort of general background. Quite aside from the mental health issue, is there And any requirement under Oregon law of notification of victims when an inmate is being released from the sentence for having committed the crime against that victim?
Yes, it's my understanding that if the victim notifies the corrections division and asks for to be notified, that they will be notified prior to the person's release. This would do the same thing. The victim, the person who would have otherwise been a victim if the person would have been found able to stand trial, has to ask to be notified, and that the Department of Human Resources would then be required to notify that person at the last address provided.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Would that existing requirement of notice that you just referred to apply where a person was convicted of the crime against the victim, but then as a result of maybe things that happened during their correction stay, put into a mental facility, so that if they're serving a sentence for that crime based on conviction, then the crime victim is notified, right?
Well, they're still, it's my understanding, they're still under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections, so it'd still be the obligation of the Department of Corrections to give that notification prior to the person's release.
Right. Further, if I could. So the intent of the bill then is where the person commits an offense against a victim, but they're not guilty because they don't have sufficient mental capacity to stand trial for it, is to say in that case, when they're being released from the supervision of a mental health facility for the based on the event that was the person was victimized by, that notification would have to be given, right?
Correct.
Right. It looks to me, if I could pursue that further line, Mr. Chair, it looks to me like the bill is a little too broadly drafted. When I look at the operative language here in Section 1.5, it refers to a person committed to a facility or non-hospital facility. Now, I haven't looked up these references, ORS 426.005 to .390. And so maybe that helps to solve the problem, but it's under any of what would look to be kind of a broad nature of being standards of commitment. The facility is required to notify a victim of any crime the person has committed. So it could be, literally, it looks to me like it could be a crime unrelated to their reason for commitment that occurred 20 years earlier.
That certainly was not the intent of the bill. It's the notification that put that person in custody committed for that particular purpose.
Okay.
Facility and non-hospital facility has specific definitions in the very beginning of Chapter 426. And generally, those are talking about facilities like, if I recall, I looked at it yesterday, the state hospital, the Eastern Oregon psychiatric facility, and then non-hospital facilities appears to cover other facilities that seem to be contracted with the Department of Human Services to handle people who have been committed.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think what will be the last question, if I could, Mr. Chair, it looks like on it, the way it's drafted now, and I think it does need some work. It would seem to put quite a burden on the mental health facility because they would have to determine what crimes that person had committed in the past and who the victims of those crimes might be, in order to be able to meet their obligation to give notification. And I'm just wondering whether there isn't some kind of mechanism we could build into this that would maybe establish at the time of commitment who the victims are, so that they, at the end of that stay, that could be accomplished, and that there's a real nexus between those victims who are getting the notification and the events that caused a person to be committed.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, certainly that's the intent. We're willing to work with council to develop amendments to achieve that purpose. I've already been in contact with council about possible amendments to make it clear exactly that it only addresses that limited situation where on that one instance the person is committed and that the victim would notify the agency and with an address and a way to be contacted so that the agency would have that on file that could contact that person prior to the individual's release.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Donald. Mr. Morris. And just briefly, kind of start out, would these amendments, would that answer some of your concerns, or if we were to amend it to narrow it down like that?
Chair Barker, for the record, my name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Mental Health Policy Manager for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And some of the issues that have already been brought up, I believe amendments would, depending on what those amendments are, might address some of our concerns that we have. I do want to indicate and stress to clarify an issue is that this is only in regards to civil commitment. This does not deal with any of the criminal commitments for those who are, for example, unable to aid and assist or those who are under the Psychiatric Security Review Board. So this is only for civil commitment, which is under 426.
Okay.
So. And our concerns are that the language is very broad and that there are no the crimes are not defined and also the timelines as far as when those crimes occurred were not clarified, so it could be an indefinite period of time. So
okay. Are there any questions? Any other questions?
I just wanted to have a point of clarification on that, Mr. Morris. You mentioned that, you know, the civil commitment doesn't cover people who are unable to aid and assist, but are you aware of situations where a criminal case is dismissed because a defendant is found to be permanently unable to aid and assist? And so in exchange for that dismissal, the state sort of gets the agreement with the defense counsel on the case that this defendant will agree to be civilly committed. Are you aware of cases yes. like that?
Yes. Chair Barker and counsel, it is true that those who are been deemed to be indefinitely unable to aid and assist, that frequently those situations, they would then proceed to a civil commitment hearing.
Okay. Well, I'll have counsel, if you could contact counsel and so we can do this really quickly, get it back with the amendments and get it out. If we can't get it out, that is. Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2974. I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2410. Representative Rosenbaum.
She's here.
And okay.
Do you want me to go ahead?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am State Representative Diane Rosenbaum from House District 42, and I'm very pleased to appear in support of House Bill 2410. I want at the outset to thank the chair of the Judiciary Committee as well as the chair of the subcommittee for hearing the bill today. House Bill 2410 addresses a very real problem that may not be known by this terminology to people who haven't already experienced it themselves, but it deals with the problem of workplace intimidation or bullying. We've heard a lot about bullying in terms of school situations with young people, and we've now identified that it can be a very psychologically damaging condition that affects people for the rest of their lives. And in fact, I think a couple of sessions ago, the legislature actually passed a law that deals with bullying in the schoolyard. But what we're here to talk about today is bullying in the workplace. So what you have in front of you is a bill that defines workplace bullying and then creates a remedy for those who have experienced it. I have to admit to you that this was somewhat of a new problem for me until the person who will be shortly testifying, Olivia Jonasson, brought it to my attention, and she has a much more compelling personal story to tell you than anything that I can identify. But I will say that after I became aware of Olivia's situation, I have been contacted by other constituents who have also been victimized in their workplaces, and I wanted to just share with you some comments that were sent to me by one of them who couldn't be here today. And this is actually a constituent of mine who works at a state agency and has found that she was dealing with a situation that couldn't be remedied under any current state law. She says, "I've had personal experience with the phenomenon of workplace bullying. We have exhausted the grievance process and followed the agency's internal policies and have gotten nowhere. It seems that management and personnel have literally no understanding of the anxiety and sleeplessness caused by managers' bullying tactics." This is somebody who actually works at PERS and is represented by a union, so has several remedies that are not available to most employees. She goes on to say, "I have come to believe that your bill contains the only solution that will gradually make agencies take more proactive steps in stopping this behavior, filing civil actions in circuit court. Your bill fills a critical gap in the current laws protecting people in the workplace, those people subject to workplace bullying that are not members of a protected class covered under discrimination law. Month after month of being exposed to workplace bullying is simply horrible when everyone in authority pretends it doesn't exist. The talent flight we have experienced recently that I believe is related to the bullying is due to the fact that most people simply look for a better job rather than submit to the behavior. They generally will not even talk about it." So I am, once again, want to thank you for allowing us to raise and educate you and members of the public about this phenomenon, and I will at this point turn it over to Mary Botkin, who will tell you a little context, and then the majority of our time we want to devote to Olivia telling her story. She's got a great deal of information.
Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for having this hearing. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I have given you written testimony. Let me just say very briefly, because I don't want to take up any undue time from the committee. Olivia came to me almost 5 years ago when she was working for a state agency and had an incredible story to tell along with a couple of her coworkers about, she referred to it as mobbing rather than bullying. It is the same thing, where coworkers and supervisors sort of gang up on somebody and discredit them professionally, and which ends up having an economic effect on them. Because most of these workers are not in a, quote, protected class under civil rights statutes, so there is no redress for them. And this bill simply says that they have a private right of action against any employer who does not provide a safe and healthy work environment. And I think that that's important to note, that this does not create a civil rights complaint, but rather moves it off into a different venue. Again, you know, I'm here every day, and so I can answer questions any of you have any day. I have a colleague with me who's actually attempted to enforce the worksite policies that we have put in place, and I'd like him to sort of take my place and follow Olivia. And with that, I'd like to introduce the committee to Olivia Jonasson, who is one of the most tenacious, nicest women I have ever met and has absolutely kept me on task on this issue. So, and Representative Rosenbaum as well.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Oh. Morning.
Good morning. And for the record, my name is Olivia Jonasson. First of all, I'd like to thank the members of this committee for having this hearing and for giving me this opportunity to talk about House Bill 2410, introduced by Representative Diane Rosenbaum. I want to first say that this legislation is different and this legislation is right, and I'll tell you why. It is different from the vast majority of bills you, the legislature, will consider during this session or any session in the future. It encompasses everyone, and I mean everyone in the Oregon workplace, and has everyone in mind. Most importantly, it is not intended to serve a special interest group, organization, company, or individual. I am referring to a status-blind harassment in the workplace. It's frequently called mobbing, bullying, psychological harassment, or workplace abuse. Although members of protected classes have some protection against such cancers in the workplace, there is no legal recourse for those of us not part of a protected class. This is not harassment based on gender, race, sexual orientation, religion, age, disability, or national origin. It is about forcing an individual out of their rightful employment through persistent and systematic intimidation, hostility, humiliation, rumors, or insults, which over a period of time impacts the targeted worker's mental and physical well-being. Eventually, the targeted person is either fired or is forced to resign from their job under duress. Participants in this abuse can be among coworkers. It can be a manager targeting a coworker. It can be coworkers and a manager targeting another employee, several managers targeting another employee, which was my case, or coworkers targeting a manager. It can take on a lot of different realms here. Bullying in the workplace impacts the organization in terms of productivity, sick leave, or disability claims filed due to stress on the job. It is also a health and safety issue. In the book, Mobbing, Emotional Abuse in the American Workplace, the authors state that on-the-job workplace bullying is attributed to 10 to 20% of suicides. I want to emphasize 10 to 20% of suicides. In the book, Brutal Bosses and Their Prey, the author estimated that as many as 20 million Americans, and I'm going to repeat that word, 20 million Americans, face this kind of abuse on a daily basis in their jobs. Economically, this translates to an enormous cost on our labor force here in Oregon and in America. Work is where we spend a third of our lives. Your work here in the legislature helps to define you as the individuals you are. This is equally true of every Oregon citizen, no matter what our job entails, be it the janitor, a manager, from the entry-level clerk to the chief executive officer. We're all entitled to work in a safe workplace environment. I was entitled to my job as the managers who mobbed me. It had nothing to do about my work. It was about two individuals using and abusing their managerial powers while working for the state of Oregon. All Oregon workers deserve protection from this kind of evil and, yes, violent behavior. That is why this legislation addressed in House Bill 2410 will move us forward to a better workplace environment for all Oregonians. Thank you. I also want to say, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, McPherson, Olson, and Krieger, I did bring copies of the book Mobbing, Emotional Abuse in the Working in the American Workplace, which you all may have. So I want to say thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Krieger.
Well, first of all, what I'm going to say, you might think I'm going to make humor out of it, but I'm really not in some ways. But the thing you brought forward actually does happen and ruins people's lives. I understand that. But when I got to looking at it, I was going down the hall. I happened to run into Senator Burdick, and I said, I want to go back and ask a question. And she's back there smiling at me. You said it was a very new problem, that it was a new problem for you, Representative Rosenbaum. there was information given here about couldn't find a remedy under any law that we have now, and that someone had to look for a better job. And then I went down and looked what was in here, and it refers to harassment, intimidation, bullying means persistent verbal act. Then it goes down that a reasonable person would find threatening, intimidating, humiliating, hostile, offensive, includes but is not limited to derogatory remarks, insults. My question would be, would this stop some of the remonstrances I've heard recently on the House floor? Well, the thing is, if this was law, I could file a complaint on every member that gets up there and goes on and on about things that I find really offensive. In fact, a week ago Thursday, Representative Ackerman asked me, what's wrong, Wayne? I said, I gave him some adjectives as I was going down the hall. So I was definitely upset. I was intimidated. I was, you know, I didn't like the verbal abuse. So I just thought we have to always be careful how someone else might take something and turn it around and use it in a manner that we didn't intend it to be. But it is serious. There are serious consequences of some of the conduct that has happened regarding this subject, and that's why you got a hearing. And Mary Barkin had talked to me about the problem that she saw with it. But I do have to leave after making those astounding statements for you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. I would just say that if anything said on the House floor has caused you to think about resigning your seat, I hope there will be another remedy created for you.
I love that law.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Rahan. I'm representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. Asked me, is my employer? I am a, my job title is field representative. I like to think of myself as an employee advocate. I've been with AFSCME for about 4 years. Currently, I represent employees at OHSU. Before that, I represented employees in local government and in private nonprofits. Before that, I spent 16 years working for the City of Portland and 8 years working for Multnomah County. Was active in the union that entire time. What brings me here today in the subject of bullying has to do with the difficulties coming from a professional standpoint, even in a union workplace, in bringing a good resolution to instances of mobbing. In my previous assignment, working especially with private nonprofits, where I attempted to get language inserted into contracts discussing mobbing or bullying, I was unsuccessful on every account. In working with the local government, we had talked about negotiations, getting something in the contract. We were not successful, nor at that time were we able to get a policy put into place. I'll tell about one instance quickly that I had towards the end of my assignment there, where we had a small office consisting of about 6 women, 5 of whom belonged to were Asian Americans. The other person was a white woman. And over a period of several months, for whatever reason, the Asian Americans started excluding the white woman from various work assignments, from various business and social functions. And over a period of time, in fact, her workload dropped to essentially nothing. She came to me after about 2 months of this with a complaint and wanted the union to do something. And in going through the union contract very carefully, there was nothing in the contract that prohibited this kind of behavior, nor at the time was there any policy put in place. The woman who actually had a master's degree in her field was very bright, very capable, and had lots of options left. She's no longer employed with that local government. I was unable to assist her. She went through a lot of emotional agony and just trying to figure out what it was that she had ever done to deserve that kind of treatment. My point being that in my experience, bullies win. And they win all the time. In fact, it's very unusual that we're able to stop that kind of behavior. If I could get into a contract, I would. I applaud any employers that have that as a policy. And in fact, OHSU does have a good and comprehensive policy. While at this point doesn't mention mobbing or bullying by name, it does talk about the behaviors associated with it. The problem is that it has no teeth. There's no enforcement. I can't file a grievance saying that an OHSU manager has failed to follow their own policy. There is an investigatory process that happens, but again, in our experience, it's been that it's not sufficient. It doesn't act to change behavior, and the bully wins. And what I mean by the bully winning is in 90% of the cases I've dealt with, the employee leaves. And the employee leaves, usually the entire employment, I mean, it's not just a transfer to another department, they're gone. And it, with the difficulty in attracting good talent and the high cost of training anymore, it's not, in most cases, in the employer's interest to allow that drain of talent to continue. But I think in a lot of cases, the employer's hands are tied as much as ours are tied. We need to have something that will help us to change the behavior of the bully, which is all, in my experience, that members who've come to me, that's all they ever want. They just want the behavior to change. They don't want anybody to get in trouble. It's very often it's difficult for folks to file a grievance. They don't want to get their coworkers in trouble. They just want to have a decent workplace. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Thank you. Now, anybody else want to testify on this bill?
Yeah, please, come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Cedric Hayden. I'm from Fall Creek, Oregon. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. I've been unable to contact my principal entity this morning, and I don't know if they would support or oppose this bill, so I checked neutral on the sheet. House Bill 2410 deals with humiliation, being offended in the workplace. We oppose these things as do... Hi, who are you?
I'm Joe Schaefer. I'm also here to testify.
Okay. Okay. I don't know, Joe.
Okay. That's okay.
As long as you don't find it intimidating.
Very good. That's a great representing person. We oppose these things, as do all reasonable people, but we ask that you not cast a wider net than is intended by this bill, remembering that humiliation is in the eye of the beholder. We ask that the committee remember the inalienable rights of freedom of speech and of freedom of religious expression. The operating principle that I present to you is that all individuals have free will and freedom of personal choice, not excluding the contact of worshiping or not worshiping a supreme being. People may choose to worship or not worship. Those that are of the Christian persuasion will be guided by the expressed wishes and commands that this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world, and the express command to go and teach all nations. This does not exclude the workplace. True believers will witness in any situation, in or out of the workplace, and it should be done tactfully. Not all believers are tactful. In their enthusiasm for their marching orders, they could be perceived as being offensive or causing humiliation. The bill makes a point. A believer may be humiliated in the workplace by an employer or fellow employees by practicing the religion even quietly, saying grace, praying to Mecca, choosing not to participate in the office pool. Religions come in and out of favor. At one time in the United States, Catholics had a pretty hard road to hoe. Incidentally, a new pope was just elected a few minutes ago to wild enthusiasm, Ratzinger of Germany, if you're curious. The protesters left England, the Protestants left England, because of oppression by the state church and the crown. And so on. Now, an adherent of an unpopular religion, be it a major religion or a sect or a cult, might even be more likely to be perceived as being offensive or offending while not intending to be. Also, a non-believer, an atheist, might
be perceived as offensive for forcefully expressing agnosticism or atheism in the workplace if most of the people there would be religious. So, to conclude, as you discuss the issue of workplace bullying, which I and the organization I represent oppose, please cut a little slack for those who will testify of their faith. There is, I think, the counsel and representing McPherson, and the other lawyers can tell you that there's plenty of boilerplate language already in statute that would make it possible to give some protection to those who might wish to witness of their faith. And with all the laws we pass, golden rule is still the best. Thank you.
I'd just like to ask you about an example. I worked at Freightliner for a while on the line down there, and there was a man there who said he believed he worshipped the devil, whatever that meant. I don't know what that meant. And he didn't want to be bothered. He didn't, you know, and so people would kind of, and I remember some people who were Christians put a Bible on his workplace, to which he, you know, was very upset about that. True. Would you consider that to be stepping over the line for somebody to put a Bible on somebody who's made it very clear they don't want anything to do with that? I mean,
I would think that that would be rude and impolite and improper and in violation of the golden rule. As to whether it would be against union work rules or a contract, who can say?
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Anybody?
Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name's Joe Schaefer.
I'm sorry, I missed you on that.
Oh, that's all right. I also apologize for misspelling your name on my testimony, so
okay.
We're even on that one. My name's Joe Schaefer. I'm a member, or I'm a staff person with SEIU Local 503 of the Oregon Public Employees Union. Currently, I'm a political organizer, but I'm a former internal organizer who focused on local governments and Marion County in particular, where my example for this legislation comes from today. But this bill offers needed protection to workers who are bullied and harassed on the job. In this country, if you're not a member of any protected class, or if the person bullying you is smart enough not to mention your race, ethnicity, or gender, age as well, there's little that can be done to protect you on the job from harassment. And this is something that I didn't really realize until I started doing work with as a union organizer and had to help employees who were constantly facing this problem. And Renee Zipser is a woman who I'm never going to forget because she was one of the first people who were really bullied on the job that I had to help. And this case for Renee, who worked for Marion County Juvenile Department, when I met Renee, she was having difficulties at home and at work. Although she had been a good employee for 20 years, 20 years as a good employee with a good work record. The new assistant director did not like her. At home, she was trying to get rid of an abusive boyfriend who she eventually had to get a restraining order against. When she began to receive persistent and threatening phone calls at work, we encouraged her to inform management so that she could receive protection. Knowing that Renee was having a hard time at work, her former boyfriend called the assistant director and suggested that they investigate her phone usage and sick leave. That's exactly what he did. And Renee received a 2-day suspension for phone calls that primarily came from her stalker. All right? There was nothing in her sick leave usage, but they did discipline her for those phone calls. All right. Renee is only one example of the bullying and maltreatment that we've witnessed in this work site. Over and over again, employees were singled out and harassed with no recourse. This legislation would help remedy a small part of this injustice, so please do support it. One thing that I think is really important to mention in this case, and there were many people involved with this, none of them were dealing with issues of poor work performance. Not once was work performance brought up in any of these cases that these people dealt with. It was solely about petty personal issues, nitpicking about if your personal phone call went more than 3 minutes, those types of things. So it was really, really disheartening to see that there was no recourse for this lady.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate the written testimony as well. Are there any further witnesses on this bill? close the public hearing on House Bill 2410 and open a work session on House Bill 2444.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2444 had its initial hearing on March 1st of this year. We heard from Judge Pratt out in Malheur County. This was a bill that would authorize a circuit court to place a probationer under the supervision of the court. We had some amendments drafted based on a couple of concerns. One of those concerns was a definition of bench probation so that there was not a confusion between bench and formal probation supervised by the community corrections people. The second thing we did was we went ahead and set the fee at $50 for every 6 months of probation or fraction thereof. And that, you may recall, is simply to cover the additional expense of having court staff do checks and stay on top of those bench probations. I did, by the way, sorry, discuss these amendments with Judge Pratt and Pat Schreiner from Marion County Parole and Probation and Kelly Skye from OCDLA, and this is something that everyone was in agreement with.
Okay. Do I have a motion to move the amendments?
Mr. Chair, I make a motion that we move the dash two amendments into House Bill 2444.
Are there any objections?
If not, it's right here.
Just give me a moment, Mr. Okay. Chair, if I could.
You bet.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Hearing no objections, so ordered. A motion for the bill, please.
And then, Mr. Chair, I make a motion that we would move House Bill 2444 as amended to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Wolf?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Excuse.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Carrier.
Sure. Representative Olson, be carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 2444. Any further business before the committee today?
Yes.
Adjourned.